Hello and welcome to another jam-packed episode of My Favorite Conservative. I am Edward.
And I am Andrea, but I am not conservative.
What?
Seriously? No, I'm not. Yes.
We'll work on it. All right.
No, we won't. But he is my favorite conservative. Oh, so I am traveling this week. So we're not live, but we have a great show for you today. We have a very special guest joining us, Randy Dillinger. Randy lives in Indianapolis. He is married and loves spending time with his two children and two stepchildren. Randy spent his earliest years in Central America, where his parents worked with local Christian communities. This experience instilled in him a passion for service that continues in his current role at a nonprofit cancer research organization. Randy considers himself progressive and enjoys thoughtful conversations with friends of all political stripes. He is currently training for his second marathon, and when not hitting the trails, he enjoys reading and noodling on the guitar. Randy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrea and Edward. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So I thought we would just tell the audience, in all fairness, you just met Edward for the first time.
I did.
Yeah. But you and I have known each other, I want to say 8 years.
That sounds about right.
That's not right. Yeah. And in the healthcare space, we've known each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we see each other occasionally at conferences, at least once a year for sure.
Yes. Yes. And it's great to get to know you on in a whole new context today.
Yeah.
Your secret life. Yes.
Yes. Yes. My secret life.
Well, Randy, it's great to have you today. Thank you for coming on. We really appreciate it. We love hearing from, you know, guests with different points of view. And in this discussion that we're all going to have, please feel free to push back on anything. We always love to, you know, mix it up, but do it in a nice way.
That's the point of the show.
Indeed.
Yes. Yes. Because we don't always agree. If you watch the show
live. Seen the last one, yeah.
You've watched the show live. Yeah, steam was coming out of my ears.
go ahead. Well, I just want to say, I love the premise of your show. The fact that you're both kind of bringing forward different perspectives. And while I think both of you are a little bit more to the right than I am, I appreciate that you really start with that point of respect. And that's what attracts me to your show, to listen, and also, you know, today to be someone who's actually contributing to your show.
Great.
Great. Well, as you probably know, it doesn't bother me when she's wrong. So no. That's...
Oh, see, I just ignore him and roll my eyes. That's how we... Yes.
All right, let me ask you. In your bio, you identify as a progressive. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
What that means to me is that I'm really interested in where we are going as local communities, as a nation. And really, I think the word progressive, of course, you have progress built into that. Hmm. What are the needs that we're facing right now? How can we make life better for our communities? That's what I consider to be a progressive mindset. Aiming toward the betterment of our local communities and our nation.
All right. So how is that different from being a liberal?
Well, generally I have liberal points of view, so I kind of approach things from that perspective, but I think someone could be a conservative progressive at the same time. Maybe I'm defining things differently than what a typical progressive would be defined as, but I have a broad appreciation for any point of view that aims to address needs in society, working toward the betterment of the condition of our neighbors and our friends, ourselves, and I think those are progressive points of view.
Well, you know, I always found it interesting that conservatives have turned the entire liberal label into a pejorative. And I think that's where a lot of liberals ran away from that and became, you know, air quotes, progressive. Whereas I think liberals have always tried to paint conservative as a pejorative, but it hasn't stuck, or we just don't care. Mm-hmm. I do find it fascinating where most people now won't identify as a liberal. Any thoughts on that?
Is that for me?
Yeah.
I don't have trouble being identified as liberal because I think that fits generally my perspectives. How somebody interprets that, I can't control. How my neighbor, how someone listening to this podcast views me. And unfortunately, labels come with very heavy baggage, and it's really sad to see. There are conversations that you can't get past that initial label. If someone hears that I'm a liberal, okay, I'm done, I'm moving on. And that's part of the problem, I think, with where we're at politically in our country.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to share a personal example. Yeah. A family member blocked us on X, not knowing it was us, but blocked us because the word conservative is in the name of our show. Now, mind you, this family member had heard from someone else that we had this show and the name, and then maybe perhaps she forgot. And when called out, she said, "I just block anyone where the word conservative is part of the title, the description, it doesn't matter." And I was thinking, like, that's closed-minded. I mean, I didn't say that to this person, but that's
probably wise
not
to.
I'm curious, Randy, given the way you grew up, which was news to me, it's so fascinating with your parents, were you ever more conservative? Did you ever consider yourself conservative?
Oh, yeah. I think I've gone through different phases of life where I've identified more as conservative or more as liberal. But I think it's always been anchored in a view of, as I said in my bio, really being driven to a life of service.
Yeah.
So, and that bears no, you know, conservatives and liberals have no ownership of a life of service. That's just ingrained in who you are. I come from, in my childhood, a conservative family, a religious family. What might be typically viewed as an American evangelical Christian background. And growing up, I certainly had that infused in who I was and my viewpoint. So I had, I was in a Christian community, very conservative community, and that really fed who I was and formed the foundation for who I am today. And that's certainly an important part of my life. Growing up, going through a Christian high school as well.
Wow, really? I did not know that.
I did. I was surrounded by very conservative points of view. And so my world and my understanding was inherently conservative at that time. Now, given my background, I certainly was exposed to a lot of different cultural environments. So yeah. I kind of grew up in Central America. I saw a lot of poverty. I saw different ways that people lived and related to each other. And I think that was very formative for me. It taught me that there's more than just the environment I'm in. There's more than just the American understanding of the world. There is value in cultural understanding and cross-cultural understanding. And so, you know, I think that has informed me over the years. So I've shifted, certainly, from that conservative upbringing to a more progressive point of view, or a liberal point of view, rather. I should not call it progressive because, you know, we're talking conservative and liberal right now. So yes,
we don't care. It's okay.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm rambling, so I apologize.
You're fine. You're fine.
Hear me back. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Where do you want to go? You want to talk about service or what?
Yeah. You mentioned service, and service is one of my core values. But what I thought was interesting in one of your emails, Randy, was you stated, "I believe I owe those who choose to serve in these roles nothing less than basic respect for taking on the demands of public service. So could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. I think by and large, people who feel drawn to serve their communities in various roles, they're doing so because they want to make the world a better place. Obviously, a lot of these are local functions. So if it's the county clerk, if it's the auditor, they're doing a public service that's very important. And they, you know, if you're getting married, if you're getting a mortgage, these are people you interact with, and they are helping you accomplish your goals. And that, to me, is really deserving of respect. It's not primarily a political position when we're looking at those kind of local functions. They're there to do a public service. And a lot of people get their start in roles like that. And then they advance, they go on to, county commissioner seats, for example, or they go on to state legislatures. Some people then go on to governorships. They go on to lieutenant governorships, statewide offices, and a few go on to public office in a national setting. Some people get to national offices without doing any of that work. We could name a few people like that, but by and large, the people that are serving the public have put in a lot of years of service to do so. So I start kind of with a default position that is worthy of respect. Their job is not easy because they get a lot of bombardment from their constituents, good, bad, ugly, all in between. And they have to deal with that. They have to find a way to balance all the demands of the people that they're serving and come out with a coherent message and policy stance to represent their constituents.
You said something there earlier that I think jumped out at me in relation to Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson wrote and spoke often about the closer decisions are made to the local community, the better. Yeah. The farther away you get from that, the more muddled and whatnot how these decisions get made. And I think as you're talking about service, I think people working locally have, you know, more skin in the game to do the right thing for their communities. But the farther away you get, it becomes way more corrupted.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm not sure what you mean by corrupted. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
It becomes more of power.
Yeah.
Is their end goal.
I'll give an example. I don't think Anthony Weiner was in it for anyone but himself. You know, I just don't, like, at any moment in his career. I mean, maybe at the very beginning, I don't know the super early beginnings of his career. Maybe he cared, but after a certain point, he just wanted to hold on to power.
Yeah, I can see your point, Edward. I think maybe the way I would describe it is the more or the greater the potential gains, the greater the potential power of the office you're holding. There's a lot of temptation that comes with that. You're drawn to that power, and your decisions have greater gravity. I can see that would be kind of a corrupting process for many people, and it would be hard to hold on to those core values that you began with, serving your local community.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview with Thomas Massie. He's a Republican Kentucky representative, brilliant man. And he was talking about, unfortunately, what he has seen in the House, and he's been there for maybe four terms, I think now, that there are only a handful of people that are there in both parties that are actually more concerned about policy versus I need to raise money and I need to get reelected because I like being a House member or a senator. But they love, you know, power is the currency of Washington. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have it, you're on the sidelines. So, it was sad to see, it really was, that people are more, you know, invested in just promoting themselves and holding on to that power.
So I wonder then, if I can ask a question, is it more important for us as citizens to be concerned with our state legislatures, with our local communities? Is the overabundance of attention we give to our national stage detrimental to where
Yeah.
really happen?
Yeah, I think conservatives are late to the party on this. I believe the left, the liberals, the progressives have been way more involved in the school boards and all the local things, and conservatives all of a sudden realized, wait a minute, this is where all these changes are happening that are trickling up, you know, into the national scene and whatnot. And I believe we're just kind of coming around now that, gee, we better get more involved on a local basis, because this is the things that really set the agenda nationally.
Well, yeah. And I think that's a great point, Randy, because, you know, having lived in Southern California over 20 years and then moving to Alabama, and I'm from the Southeast, so it should not have been a shock to everyone, but it was. But moving to Alabama, you know, I can say that, yeah, each state is its own experiment. That was the way the founding fathers wanted it to be. And what I experienced, for example, during our live show today when I got really heated, what I experienced during COVID living here in Alabama is not what my friends back in Southern California experienced during COVID. You know, it was like so radically different. Everything was different. So I think that's a really good point about sometimes we may give too much attention at the national level. And I definitely think you have to pay attention to your local politicians.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about Alabama is I think everyone knows it's a conservative state, but Birmingham is very liberal. It's we have a Democratic mayor. So
yeah, let me ask you this. Let's turn the topics here a little bit in terms of the national rhetoric and the Trump assassination attempts recently. Mm-hmm. What's your overall view on that? Give me a bird's eye.
It's distressing to see how much the political rhetoric has amped up over the years. I have to believe that the rhetoric is what fuels people's actions. And I want to qualify this by saying not everybody is going to be motivated to get up and commit an act of violence. But there are certain people in society who, for whatever reason, are really inflamed by rhetoric. And they sort of latch on to a point of view and become militant in wanting to see things happen that emerge out of those points of view. And I think these people are just primed and ready.
I was going to say, I think what has made it not even 10, I'm going to say 100 times worse is social media.
I totally agree. I feel like I'm not articulating this very well, but I do feel that, you know, all and social media is a key part of this. It has really inflamed is about the best word I can think of. It's inflamed the conversation. And I can't blame any one person. I can't blame Trump and his viewpoint for causing this issue. I think really the media that we are plugged into is what perpetuates this ongoing and snowballing effect that's out there. If we just kind of take a step back and say, look, let's get back to policy. Let's get back to respect. Tone things down. I think it's very important to tone things down and be mindful that the words that we use are going to inflame people. They're going to inflame people that already have those triggers built into them. And so let's do society and let's do our candidates a solid and just pull things back. nobody wants to see a candidate be the target of an assassination attempt.
Agreed. Let me say, when I first heard about it, the first time in Butler, where he actually escaped death by millimeters?
Yeah.
My first thought was obviously concern, and then it was outrage. And then I started thinking, this is a 20-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Obviously with some mental health issues. And then I thought, for the last 8 years that they've been going after Donald Trump, calling him Hitler and everything else, this kid was 12 years old when he started hearing this. So for basically his entire life that he really can form a lot of coherent thoughts, it's been Trump bad, Hitler, everything else. And I don't see a lot of assassination attempts of people from the right trying to kill people on the left. And I think there's this Trump derangement syndrome is real. And I guess my question to you is, we obviously have different perspectives on things, but so many people that I thought were rational people.
I know who he's talking about.
If you mention the word Trump to them, it is like their head starts doing the exorcist, where it starts spinning around. And that's not an overstatement.
It's not, unfortunately.
There is something there that triggers them. Are you seeing that in your community or who you're dealing with?
Well, I'll just speak from my own personal experience, if I may. So when Trump first ran for the 2016 election, and I was kind of witnessing the things that he was saying, I was shocked. I was really floored that any political candidate would use the kind of words he was using to talk about communities of people, especially. And I thought, there's no way he's going to get elected. He will not make it.
The Republican Party didn't think so either.
I did not think so at all.
Nobody did. But, you know, to his credit and his political savvy, he found a way. I would consider myself among those who were very shocked and very much, the head exploding kind of reaction when you hear Trump brought up in conversation. So I can identify with that to some degree. I don't see a lot of that in Indiana right now. I think we're in a very conservative state. We have a conservative supermajority in our state house. We have pockets of liberalism here and there. I live in Indianapolis, which is certainly more liberal than the surrounding communities. So there, you know, where I'm at, things are a little bit more mixed, a little bit more both left and right representation. But to be a Trump supporter is actually still, I think, the majority in Indiana. I don't expect that we're going to be
You guys, you're not a swing state like us.
You're sounding like Alabama.
Yeah.
This is exactly what we are in Alabama. We are in a deep red state, but our neighborhood is very blue. And interesting. Because we're by the University of Alabama, Birmingham.
So. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, Edward, but, having been through that period of my head exploding various times during the Trump presidency and even after, it's taken a while to come back to a point where I can just say, okay, you know what? I'm going to take a personal step back myself and not react to things as I used to.
That's very good to hear. It's very good to hear.
Yeah. All right. You want to talk about a couple issues?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what are your thoughts on immigration and the border? And I wanted to start with that just because, and we're only going to talk about a few. Because I would say that that's where Edward and I agree 100%. And
well, that and his background of coming from.
Yeah. We would love to know, given your background as well. So what are your feelings about immigration and the border?
Yeah. I'm happy to talk about this. In fact, I've written up some notes to help me out. But certainly, having come from a background where we lived in Central America, that does give me a perspective that maybe a lot of Americans don't have. I don't live in a border state, so I cannot speak to the tensions that are happening right at the border. But I do know that there are a lot of issues that drive people to the border. The Central America that I'm familiar with, the areas that I lived in, certainly one of the drivers is a gang culture that targets individuals and targets families. You have situations where people are taken hostage by a gang, and then, you know, the expectation is that you're going to be given money in return to have your loved one returned to them. Mm-hmm. There are dangers for families, especially those who are who somehow go crosswise with the gang cultures. Haiti, of course, is another community we're hearing a lot about right now.
Right.
And the gang violence, the gang rule that is happening in Haiti is a big driver, as I understand it, of people leaving the country. What I'm sharing, what I'm intending to share with this is that there are forces that are causing people to want to leave the country. And so by whatever means, they end up on our shores, they end up at our border. Some cross the border illegally. Some go through an asylum process. They're here. And to me, and again, kind of coming back to my service mindset, we have people in our communities that are here who need support. Some are legal, some are illegal. But my humanitarian nature says, if they're hungry, feed them. If they're sick, give them medical care. What happens politically is going to happen politically. If someone is deported because they're here illegally, that's going to happen. But in the meantime, let's bring the conversation to a point where we can at least meet the needs that are before us.
But and should see, we?
Wait, no,
we
have, I'm good. Nope.
Go
nope.
Ahead.
Deal with the cat, please. Okay. We apologize if you hear a meowing cat in the background.
No problem.
She's decided it's dinner time. It's not. Well, it sort of is for her. But this is what is interesting to me, because I didn't realize when I was young that this was more of a sort of a libertarian policy. But I have always been of the mindset that we have to take care of Americans first before we take care of the rest of the world. And that's why I said this is probably the policy that where Edward and I are most aligned. Because I do think we need to close the border. I understand why people want to come to America, but I do think we need to close the border. I do think we need to take care of citizens first. I do think that if people want to come to this country, that they need to assimilate. And there was a time in the early 20th century when, you know, that was sort of part of the American culture, right? And that's why we closed immigration for so many decades, was because we wanted all the immigrants coming over from Europe to assimilate. And so I think this is where I really struggle, because, you know, I have a great heart and I'm very compassionate, but I feel like we have to take care of Americans first. And so I guess bottom line is that I disagree.
You know, sure. I find it interesting with us and relating it to Europe, because we both have immigration problems. Ours are bringing in a lot of violent criminals from, you know, especially Central and South America. There, over in Europe, they're getting the radical Muslims coming. And there's two countries in Europe that aren't having a huge spike in crime, murders, rapes, everything else. And that's Hungary and Poland.
It's because they closed their border.
Those are the only two countries that literally close their borders. And, mm-hmm. you know, I appreciate compassion, absolutely. But we have a legal immigration system. We do not need our government to throw open the gates, of which I completely think the Biden administration did. You know, what did he issue, 90-something executive orders in the first week to basically say, here we are. When you see tens and tens of thousands of people coming across our border with Biden shirts on and saying, thank you, Joe Biden. We cannot support this. Like Andrea was saying, we have to, you know, you've got, you know, the difference was back in the early 20th century when people came here, there wasn't a safety net. There were not handouts. You were not staying at a 4-star hotel. You were not getting your meals and a debit card with money on it and everything else. It is shameful that we have, you know, veterans sleeping on the streets and kids not being able to go to their gymnasiums at schools because they're being used to house illegals. And I completely understand the compassion point of view, being a Christian myself, but this has to stop. The immigration has to benefit the host country first. It has to be a benefit to us. And importing literally millions of under or uneducated poor people is no rhyme or reason for that whatsoever. That's my rant. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do want to say I respect your points of view. I do. And I don't disagree that we need a very clear policy to address the flow of illegal immigration across the border. I don't disagree with that point. I'm not learned enough to know exactly what those policies should be. I just know that it's a very difficult question that many people have been wrestling with over time. My big, the point that I come back to is for those who are here, if there is a need, that's where I think we have an obligation to meet the basic human needs. And not only of those who are here from other countries, but yes, the veterans who are on the street absolutely need support. Absolutely. And, you know, I would say that supporting American citizens, that's a priority for the country. I wouldn't say that we support immigrants to the detriment of those who are here already and those who are our citizens. There's got to be a prioritization. But I think given that we are a rich country, we can do this. It's not an either or, it's an and both, in my opinion.
I will disagree with that at all. We're $34, $35 trillion in debt right now. Printing more money is not going to solve this solution. But let me back up here.
Well, then let's go to the next. Yeah, well, take us to the next topic.
Hold it. Okay. But I don't think it's a good policy or a humane policy to tell people to come to our country. And the reason I say that and the way it's been done is 70% of women that are coming up from Central and South America are being sexually assaulted, raped.
Unaccompanied women
are being raped. You've got 325,000 missing children that are probably in the sex slave trade right now. To me, that is not a compassionate stance, and trying to present it from the government's point of view as, oh, these people just need help. Well, I'm sorry. I don't think we should be putting these people through a journey like that and losing, you know, over a quarter of a million kids. To me, that's not compassionate. That's the opposite of it. Mm. And trying to veil it under a cloak of compassion is just wrong. Now I'm done with my rant. Thank you. I'll be here all week.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. And if I could just add to that, I know that the conditions that people endure in their journey to get to the border is very difficult. And there are those who take advantage of that situation. And that's a tragedy. I completely agree with you. That's a tragedy.
So on that topic, since you brought up the debt, what are your thoughts about the economy and maybe more specifically inflation? And something that, and I think, I think we got so much flack from both sides, but like we immediately said in the one and only debate, Trump versus Harris, we said Trump lost that debate. And I don't think, and people were really mad at us about saying that. But I don't think Trump brought up that famous line. I think it's a Reagan line, right? Are you better off now than you were four years ago? And if you're only looking at inflation, what are your thoughts about that? Compared to the Trump time versus now?
I think overall, 4 years is a relatively small time when you're looking at economic trajectories, economic growth. Looking back 4 years, personally, my situation has not changed that much. Obviously, I see higher prices in the grocery store. I see higher prices at the gas pump, like all Americans do. And I get frustrated by that. I get frustrated how expensive certain things are. The part of the economy that I think frustrates me the most is the cost of housing. Thinking about if we want to move at some point, the cost of a house is going to be significantly higher now than it was 5-10 years ago.
And so is your mortgage.
Exactly.
Interest rate, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So finding that ideal time to make a move, you have to play a game. You have to
wait for the market to crash. You do. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So, there are obvious frustrations that are there, but I don't feel as driven by our economic condition right now as many people do.
Well, consider yourself very fortunate because
I do.
Most people are really hurting. They haven't gotten 20% raises at all. In fact, their purchasing power has gone way, way down. And, how do I say this nicely here? Being insulated the way you are, at least in your job, which is great, and I'm happy for you on that. But most people out there, most people are struggling. And I know you say you look back at 4 years and it's not that long a time, but there are demonstrable differences. When Donald Trump left office, inflation was 1.4%. Even now, after Biden and Harris ended up to 9.1%, it's still about 3%, which is over twice what it was when they came in. And these have real life consequences for these people out here, and us included. I mean, we're spending way more of our income for food, especially. And
we don't eat that much.
But when the government thinks that the way you fight inflation is by spending a couple trillion dollars more to fight it, it's ridiculous. I'm a former bond trader, and all I did is I'd worked with institutions and I would look at economic numbers all day long. They were like the Bible to us. So I understand all these numbers that are coming out, and you can't go on this trajectory that we're on. And by wanting to give, four more years to this same mentality that if you just put more money into it, that's going to solve it, it's going to make it the exact opposite. And I think that's been proven out. I think we're at a great time in our history where you've got someone running for president who has a track record, and you've got the other person who has a track record, and they're back to back. And I think he said this to me the other day, if you took the candidates' names off of anything, and you just put down the issues and the responses or the solutions that each candidate had for them, you might be shocked on who you think you should vote for.
If you blinded the candidates,
that's what I was saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you blinded them if you didn't. Yeah. Okay. So I'm just trying to be cognizant of the time. Your phone is not right, by the way. Okay. So I think you kind of set this up really nicely, though. This is going to air after the election. So we thought it'd be kind of fun, kind of switch gears and lighten it up a little bit and discuss the candidates. And then we're going to make some predictions. So how did you feel about Kamala replacing Biden on the ballot? And I'll leave it like that. I won't say a word. How did you feel about that
process?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it was absolutely needed, absolutely necessary for Joe Biden to step down as a candidate, not only for the Democratic ticket, but for the good of the country.
Let me jump in here real quick. Did you feel that way before the debate? Or was that the trigger point?
No, that was a trigger point for me.
Okay.
But what about I guess we did a whole episode on this, and this, I was so disenchanted. I'm a registered independent anyway, but why not have an open convention, right? Because there were a lot of other candidates, a lot of other possibilities, and no one actually voted for her. Right. So what are your thoughts on that as a voter? Yeah. As a voter, like, what are your thoughts that, like, literally nobody voted for her to be the presidential nominee? It was given to her.
Well, I haven't thought very carefully about that question, but I think there's an element of time involved in this. There is not and was not a lot of time to probably open up the floodgates for candidates. Kamala had a direct line to the funding that was already raised by Biden's team. And so I think if I put my Democratic Party cap on, it makes sense that you have somebody that can inherit the strength of the war chest that's been accumulated. Kamala being, in some ways the obvious successor because she's the VP. But as a voter, I do have, I don't know a lot about her, and I like certain things about her. I have a lot of questions, things that I would like to learn more about. And given that I have a busy schedule and limited time, it's hard to find the time to really dive in and explore who this person is and how they're going to behave as a president if they're elected.
I'm not sure she would answer your questions directly.
Well, we do know she's from a middle-class family. She was raised middle class.
But what I like about the process, though, is with Biden stepping out and someone, anyone else, stepping in to fill that gap, someone who is younger, there's the obvious energy that has come to the campaign. And I think not only to the Democratic campaign, but to both campaigns, to the Republican and Democratic campaign, there's a renewed energy, it feels to me.
Oh, sure.
That wasn't there before.
No, so I will say that she's younger. Anybody would have been younger than Joe Biden, first off, right?
Fair enough.
However, and I understand about the money components of it.
That was
completely understand. What kind of really pisses me off is Nancy Pelosi, just the other day, when she was asked about it, the same question, why didn't we have a choice? And mm-hmm. she said, well, there was an open primary. Nobody chose to run against her. Really?
You mean against Biden initially?
No, against Harris.
But
she said that when Kamala, when Joe stepped aside and said he wasn't going to run, that you had an open primary, but nobody decided to run.
There was no open primary.
I mean,
primary.
Come on. I can take smaller lies, but just don't, slap me in the face with it. And everybody saw what happened, and such an insult to everybody's intelligence. So I give her credit for having the guts to say it.
She doesn't care.
That's a certain skill that I'll never have. I can't just sit there and lie to somebody knowing, and everybody else knows, right?
Well, there's a lot of conversations that happen in the background that were never privy to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure. But, unfortunately, the Democratic Party has a little bit of a history of that. Look at 2016, right? You've got Bernie, you've got they muscled Bernie out by giving Hillary, answers to questions in a debate.
And then the superdelegates.
Superdelegates, right? Then you've got 2020 and they go and Bernie is, taking off. And boy, they kneecapped him pretty quickly, with some deals that Biden made with James Clyburn. So, unfortunately, there's a little bit of a history there. So, I was not totally shocked that this is the way they performed.
But I was shocked because Biden didn't need to step down. I think the three of us can agree on that. And I actually was really furious with Jill Biden. Because I thought it was elder abuse. I thought it was, as my grandmother had Alzheimer's for 10 years, it was so hard to watch Joe Biden this past year. And I was so furious. Like, I was like, you're his wife, you're his spouse, you should be protecting him. But I don't think, at least I didn't initially, and the people I know who would probably be more in line with your beliefs, Randy, I don't think anybody thought it was going to be Kamala. I mean, really, even though it seems logical, and you're right, that war chest was super important, there were so many other people that it could have been. And I think deep down, a lot of people wanted Michelle to run, Obama, but she did not want to. And she made that clear, and you know, good for her for not giving in to what was probably a lot of peer pressure. But I was shocked that they just gave it to Kamala, that there wasn't an open convention. Mm-hmm. I would have been excited by that. That would have been cool.
Oh, would have been, yeah, popcorn, you know, time in front of the TV for sure.
Well, you for a different reason than me, but yeah. I just wanted to see a fair and open convention. I really did. I did. Where the people chose. Is there any other candidate that you would have liked as much or more than her, or you know more about?
Well, being an Indiana resident, of course, we're very familiar with Pete Buttigieg.
And oh yeah, of course.
I would have supported a Pete candidacy. I think he's very articulate and has done well. And it'll be interesting. I would imagine that if the Democratic ticket wins, he'll have some role in
the
new administration, and you know, maybe not transportation secretary, but maybe another more significant role. I think he's got a trajectory yet ahead of him.
No, I think even if the Republicans win this, he's going to be a rising star still.
Yeah,
because he's young and he's articulate.
Really young.
Oh yeah,
he's not Kamala young. He's really young. He's not Gen Z. He's a millennial. Even then, he's like a slightly younger millennial. Let's do predictions.
Okay.
You know what? I'm not going to make our guests go first. I'm going to make you go first.
Okay.
And then Randy and then me.
All right. I will tell you the winner.
We have not discussed this ahead of time at all.
I will tell you the winner and I will tell you the number of electoral votes.
Oh, God. Okay. I'm not going to get that specific.
Donald John Trump will win with 272 votes.
Okay. Will he win the popular vote?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm not sure a Republican will ever win the popular vote again.
Okay.
I mean, California is too big and too one-stated. It just throws it out of whack.
He's been playing a lot with the interactive electoral map lately. So clearly.
Just saying.
So you don't have to give us electoral votes. What, Randy, who do
Thank
you
think? Thank you.
Who do you think is going to win?
I think Kamala Harris is going to win, but it's going to be very close. And I think we're going to have a drawn out, contested discussion after the election.
Yeah, you know, you said something. This is going to air after the election. We may still not know.
Oh, that's true. That's true. We may not know.
We could air this in late December. Right?
Yes. If that's the case, we'll put a little, like, we'll add a little bit more audio. Oops, I lost my earpiece. Okay. Thank you, sir. Okay. I predict, oh boy, this is tough. Okay, I'm not going to do electoral votes. I predict that, oh boy, I don't know. I think based on what we've seen and the people we've spoken to, I believe that Trump will win, but only if there's no obvious cheating. I know it sounds like a weird caveat on either side. There should be no obvious cheating there, but I mean, I would give anything for like same day voting and things like that and whatever, but we're already in voting season. But I think he will, because when you look at the battleground states, his path to victory is easier than her path to victory when you look at the battleground states. So, but you're right. It might go on for weeks. I mean,
Let's hope not.
let's hope not. God, let's hope not.
You almost hope for a runaway from either side just to shut everybody up.
It would be nice.
And let's move on.
It would be nice. Yeah. I actually think that would be better. I think that would be better.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, can I throw out a thought for you guys?
Yeah, of course.
Wherever we end up at the end of the election, when all the votes are counted, when all the litigation is done.
Please no litigation, but keep going.
Yeah. my big hope for everyone, for our country, is that we can get back to working together for the good of the country, understanding we may not agree on all the issues, but let's focus on our common goals and work toward toward progress in the things that we all agree on.
I hope so. I hope so.
Amen to that.
I am worried. I'm worried about actually either side wins. I'm worried how the other side's going to react. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like just
violently.
Yeah. Yes, I'm very worried about that, but
please don't.
Yes. Randy, thank you so much for joining us today. And let us know if you want people to follow you on social media. If not, no worries. For everyone else, we are live most Sundays when I'm not traveling at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 1 p.m. Eastern. If you're listening to the podcast, which always drops the next day, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you're listening right now. And you can support our show by joining our Locals community. And you can learn more about us, about our guest, at myfavoriteconservative.show. That's myfavoriteconservative.show. Randy, thank you so much.
Thank you
both. It's been a pleasure to be with you today. And yes, folks can follow me on social media. It's mostly work related, but you can find me on X at R. Dillinger.
All right. We will put that in the show notes. Thank you.
Thank you so much.